Welcome to the Primal Endurance Podcast. Slow down and enjoy the show, where we rap, literally, about everything you need to know. I'm your host, Brad Kearns. Are you ready? Let's go. Okay, listeners, welcome to the Southern California studios of the podcast, joined by our frequent and most common recurring guest, Andrew McNaughton. Once again, it's been a while. Thanks for coming, Andrew.
If there's anyone common, it's Andrew McNaughton.
A commoner, heart down to his core. We were checking in offline, chit-chatting, as we usually do, where we get our greatest ideas on those
long-ranging calls. And then once it's time to record, we've forgotten what we said.
Yeah, where's my notepad? But we did get into some interesting threads, and I thought that would be good fodder for a show. Especially, just like you said before we started recording, we may not have all the answers here, but we want to talk about the issue. And one of them that's really interesting to me right now is that grand question of the trade-off between the pursuit of health and longevity and delaying the aging process on one side, and on the other side, peak performance and competing and aspiring to ambitious athletic goals and endurance events that are so popular, and where do they all fall into place so that you can achieve all these possibly disparate goals if they're in conflict sometimes?
Yeah, I think that they pretty much are in conflict. I think that they're almost mutually exclusive. I think there's a certain amount of fitness that can be done healthy or healthfully. But in general, fitness and health are mutually exclusive. Health obviously is more important because then you can do these events, whether they're realistic or unrealistic. It doesn't really matter if you're healthy. You can still figure out how to get them done and, you know, do some fairly responsible training, not lose too much health in the process of getting fit for your event. But remember, the goal is always health, or at least it is for me and the people I work with. And so you back off and you let your body recover properly and fully. Make sure you're eating really well and sleeping well, before you wind it up again and look for another competition, if that's what drives you. For me, I have mostly no interest in competing. Every so often I find that I'm in shape and then I say, well, maybe I'll do one. But in general, I don't exercise to get in shape for a competition. I just do what I like to do, you know.
Well, we've talked about this on prior shows, and my speculation that, you know, your training has evolved to the highest level to the point where one of your great quotes was, I let my moods dictate my training decisions. And if someone's just tuning in right now or checking in and taking that quote and then stopping the recording and going on their next bike ride, it would seem sort of ridiculous. But this is, you're 30 years into this game. You've sought guidance from the greatest coaches and athletes. And we tell that story of going up to see Dave Scott when we were rookie professional triathletes and him laying out this very detailed scientific program, which was really ambitious and was really tiring to try to adhere to.
And then in Boulder in the summer of 90, I basically hung out with Dave like I suction cupped myself to his thigh. And I just hung out with him for 2 months and absorbed anything and everything I could. He wasn't training much that summer, but we did a lot of hanging out and just chatting, and yeah, it was a lot of fun, actually.
So you've been exposed to all the information, all the best practices of the world's greatest athletes in endurance, and then come to this point where you can cough up a quip like that. I think it's really profound. I think the listener needs to reflect on that your moods, your whims, these bursts of inspiration, perhaps, or bursts of fatigue and malaise need to be really carefully paid attention to, because I think they can inform the best training decisions. But generally speaking, we're talking this population of like type A people who want to pay for a schedule and they promise to adhere to that no matter what. And it's a great dynamic for their type A trainer to say, yeah, you're doing great. We're on week 13 of our build to this big race. And, we've kind of called that out as some bullshit these days, because we're not talking about mules here or robots. We're talking about, you know, dynamic people that do have ups and downs and whims and things.
I was talking to a friend of mine, and I've coached him on and off for probably 15 years. And we were talking about it, and he said, so what are you doing now? And I said, well, if I feel like going running, I put my shoes on and I run out the door. And when I get to the end of my community, I have to go left, and that's sort of rolly along the road, or right, and that's hilly in the trails, and rarely do I decide which way I'm going to go until I get there.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love that.
And I was talking to him about swimming, too. I said, I show up to the pool when I want to be there, and I jump in, and I do 100 free, and then I do 400 free back. And then at the end of that, I decide if I want to get out or if I want to keep going or what I want to do. Some days I feel like doing a big block where I do a 2,000-yard set of varying distances or constant distances or whatever. Or sometimes I don't think my brain is into it that much, so I do a bunch of broken 400s or 500s so I can regroup and think about it and take a break every 5 or 6 or 7 minutes. And it just depends on my mood at that moment, and I don't go with any plan because, well, first of all, I'm not focusing on an event, so there doesn't need to be any structure. Mine is just for fun.
And you're still talking, but this guy's voice. This guy's telling you.
No, I'm telling him how to do this.
Oh, okay.
Because he wants to get in shape again. I said, this is what you need to do. You know how to train already.
Yeah.
You know, we've been talking on and off for 15 years about how to do this. So it's like, it's not like you need me to give you a workout. You don't need me to tell you how to swim. You swam in college. You don't need me to do any of this stuff. You need to show up at the pool because you want to be there and, you know, swim as much as you want or as little as you want, you know. And eventually, as the race, as you get in better shape, it's really easy to do, you know, for me, it's really easy to do about 3,500 yards. I don't get bored. I don't look at my watch, you know, wondering how long I've been here or whatever. I enjoy the whole time. And if I'm not enjoying it or whatever, then I get out at 1,500 or 1,200 or 500. But I never go unless I want to, and I stay as long as I'm having fun. But rarely do I stay for more than 4,000 yards.
We floated this idea out there before, and I have received some resistance from people that are generally afraid to embrace this type of training decision making process. They're afraid that maybe they're going to get out of shape or they're going to be too lazy. Is oftentimes I hear a comment coming back that, oh, I need a schedule. I need to stay accountable to something. Otherwise, I just sleep in every day. What's your response to that type of pushback?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, in my initial conversations with people that were, you know, possibly going to work with together and form some sort of co-op, I'm not really interested in working with people who needed to be motivated. So I never really have gravitated to the personality that thinks that they need to be accountable. The people that I end up working with are people I have to slow down, who do too much and get caught up in the program. And what I deal with is more people are concerned that they miss a workout than making a workout. And so that's why we've talked about this before, is I can't give people a schedule, do this on Monday, this on Tuesday, this on Wednesday, because if they miss 2 days, then they try to do all 3 days in one, because that's just the way their brain works. Because that's the way in their job, if they don't get stuff done, they still have to get it done. So they do it all until it's done, right? And in training, it's not like that. Every 24 hours is its own 24 hours. And there's only so much you can do in that 24 hours. And once it's gone and you move on, right? You don't try to make up. There's no such thing as makeup, right? So those are the people that I primarily work with. I've never really worked with someone who had trouble getting out of bed for this stuff. My thinking is, if you're having trouble getting out of bed, it's probably because you're doing too much already.
Right. I think there is very, very few, if any, people that have gravitated toward ambitious endurance goals that have that lazy personality attribute. However, they verbalize that they think they do. And it's probably that that's coming into play, where they've referenced their past, where they flaked out on workouts. It's probably because they were ridiculously tired, and they thought it was their mind being lazy, but, you know, didn't really understand what was going on.
So this is one of my favorite things to say, is endurance athletes are never truly content with their exercise until they're in a state of overtraining.
Right.
That sense of overtraining is what we as endurance athletes feel is normal. And unless we feel that sort of sense of deep fatigue, we don't think we're doing enough, because that's what we associate as being as normal. And that's not normal, obviously. It's overtraining. So we need to re-educate ourselves and make that shift, that if you, in fact, don't feel like doing something, odds are it's because your body's telling you that you've already been doing too much and you need to chill out. Now, there are some people that, you know, need to be accountable, and they do need to show up at a, you know, with a group because they can't do it on their own, or they need to, you know, be distracted and listen to music. I'm not one of those people. I love the running. I like checking into my body when I run. Same with cycling, same with swimming. I don't need any distractions. I like to be present. I don't really understand that personality that well.
I'm sorry, we don't understand you.
And so, you know.
But you can coach them because you'll relate to them as soon as they start showing their cards.
Yeah, well, I guess I can coach them. I don't know. I don't really understand them. So probably there's someone who's a better coach for you than me. If you're someone who, you know, needs constant distraction with music and you can't ride your trainer without video and all that sort of stuff. When I ride the trainer, I pretty much just ride the trainer. And it's just me and my heart watch and my watt meter.
Yeah, speaking of Dave Scott, there was a good line in his book. This is now, 30 years ago when he put out his book, but he and Mark Allen both putting out books in the 80s was some of the best memorable lines that I've ever seen, and they still hold true. And one of the things he said was, people ask him what he's thinking about doing this Ironman thing because it takes all day, and he goes, I think about what I'm doing at that moment. So it's pedaling his bike, it's making a smooth swim stroke and exiting with his tricep fully extended and all that stuff. And that's kind of the beauty and the meditative aspect of endurance training. Mm-hmm. Now with all the technology, we can bypass that for the first time really, really easily. In our day, you could get your Walkman cassettes out there and you know, get some music going, but oh my gosh, now it's like you can learn a foreign language while you're putting in your miles and possibly compromising the beauty of the experience accordingly.
Yeah, well, the races, the way I explain a race is constant decision-making. Every time you go to a race, is all you're going to be doing is evaluating this moment and making the decision. The decision is, am I going the right pace? Am I eating enough? Am I drinking enough? Am I eating too much? Am I drinking too much? Am I going too fast? Am I going too slow? How do I feel? Those are the things that are going on in your head the whole time. Never do I think, oh gosh, it's beautiful here. I should stop and take a picture, or damn it, this isn't the song I want to listen to, and then pull over and change it so that it's the right song. I'm always thinking about what it feels like, especially in an event, and making the best decision I can with the information I have in that moment, knowing that it's way more important to make a quick decision, because in another 30 seconds, you're going to have to make another quick decision and there's no time to deliberate on anything in the swim, bike, or run. You just need to make quick decisions, the best ones you can with the information you have now, move on, because you're going to have to make another one. You know, and that's what you should be thinking about. At least that's what I think.
Yeah, I've read some articles referencing these psychological studies of athletes and showing that those in the elite category, the faster people are by and large present and focus on what they're doing. And then the disassociation group are the people that are more recreational. So it's possibly okay when you're out there training to be solving problems in the workplace or thinking about something besides putting one foot in front of the other for 2 hours of running, but especially in a competitive setting, due to all the potential for ruining your race if you're going out too fast because you're so excited that you're in the top 50 in Hawaii and you're riding up there at an elevated heart rate. You really got to keep your head together no matter what level of athlete you're at. And I think especially you hear the people recounting their marathon performance. And they say when they got to mile 20, all they could think about was the beer and the barbecue ribs that they were going to eat later that night. And that, the experts show that this makes it much, much tougher than staying focused and engaged in the present. To be thinking about that finish line and taking yourself away from the present is going to produce more psychological stress and make it more difficult to get to the finish line.
Yeah, I have to agree. I had a thought that came in one ear and out the other as you were talking, and I've forgotten what I was going to say.
That's because you weren't totally focused like a racer.
I was too focused on what you were saying instead of what I wanted to say.
Yeah. I mean, I'm saying it's kind of fun to disengage at times, but when you're competing or doing something with a great purpose, you want to stay focused.
Okay, so this is what I wanted to say. One of the things I love about these three sports, one of the many things, but this is one of the things I love, is no matter what's going on in your head and how many distractions you have, when you jump into the pool, it brings you right into that moment because your whole body temperature changes. You're in a completely different space, and all of a sudden you're brought right into the present. And the same thing with running. Even if you start off and your brain is musing about 40 things that were annoying during the day, that gentle pounding, the rhythmic pounding, however long it takes, sometimes it's 5 minutes, sometimes it's 30 minutes, but by some point in that run, I am happy and enjoying it and smiling. And I noticed that when I'm running by people on the trails, they always take a double look because there's this wackadoodle who's smiling while he runs. And it's like, people don't think that that's normal. And it may not be normal, but it's just the way it is. Running makes me happy. And so I have this sort of little smile on my face as I run along, no matter where my brain was when I started. And swimming does that too. Cycling takes more concentration because I do mostly mountain biking now. So you really have to pay attention because I'm not really that good at it. So that sort of brings me right into the now. Otherwise, I'm afraid I'll be on the ground, and that's never good.
Same with road riding. You have to navigate the automobile, You can't be letting your mind wander.
Yeah. There is that too. I haven't road ridden in so long that I'd probably be freaked out the first few times.
It's time for a commercial about road riding. Please be super, super careful out there. I want you to get a little notepad out and make a list of the 10 most dangerous things that you do in your daily life. And if you're a bicycle rider,
put that at the top
on the road, I guarantee you that's number one. Unless, I don't know, if you're a Navy SEAL or someone in an extremely dangerous job, that's the job's probably number two.
Bull riding.
All that stuff. Bull riding. But
lobster fishing in the North Sea or something?
That's
like
the most dangerous career, the deadliest catch. So if you're a fisherman up there, best of luck to you on your road riding. You probably don't give a crap about what two guys are saying in busy urban area where cycling is very dangerous. But I do want to put that plug in there because anyone in the cycling endurance community has been touched by the tragedy of cars and bicycles interacting out there in a bad way.
And I'm not sure if there's more now or if it's the same number, but through social media, we're just aware of them. But it seems like there's a lot, you know, there seems like there's a lot of people getting, you know, bumped or bumped off or even, you know, injured or seriously injured or killed. It's something, you know, to be aware of and be careful.
I am going to say back in my time, decades ago, there were no giant SUVs. And most importantly, there were no personal digital devices distracting the driver. So we have very dangerous road conditions. And if you insist on doing this stuff, I would say find yourself a bike trail or a safe route, even if it takes a drive from your home, and start and end all your bike rides in a safe place. Just because you live somewhere and you like the convenience of riding to your house, that puts you at high risk every time you're out there.
Yeah, especially dawn and dusk as well, when the sun's low. They can't
Right, and the color thing. I mean, if I was going to ride today, I would get one of those safety flags or a helium balloon, a helium machine in my garage to pump a balloon up, but get entirely 100% neon garments every time I ride with the yellow or the safety orange.
So Jordan
be an obnoxious, you know, contribution to the scenery on the road.
Jordan did some reviews on lights for front and back of your bikes, and apparently those make a big difference. I know that when I'm riding my bike, I can see them. When I'm driving my car, I mostly drive on the freeway because I live fairly close to the freeway. But yeah, I noticed them, and they're supposed to make a huge difference. A bright light in the front that blinks, you know, that strobes during the day.
During the day?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Why not?
It catches your eye, and same with the back one, you know, and because otherwise you're less likely to notice a bike, but if there's some sort of flashing light, you know. Those are apparently worth it. And I know most of my friends now actually ride with one either on their hat or if they have one bike, then they have them fixed to their bars and their seat and stuff. And so that helps. We sort of got sidetracked.
Oh, that was a commercial. I told you it was a commercial.
A PSA.
What, do you want to hear me hawk some products, or would you rather hear me concerned about your safety? And welcome back to the show. We need to put a jingle behind that. Dun, 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 dun. Watch out on the bike. Okay, so back to, we started out the conversation talking about that looming question, the trade-off between
health and fitness,
peak performance, and longevity, anti-aging. And it's become of great interest to me. I've talked about this on recent shows also, that, you know, doing my nutritional consultations, There's the show on Dr. Tommy Wood that you can hear about my particular case and what they do. And one of the big suggestions that came out of it was, hey, this keto stuff's going great. You're fat adapted. You can fast comfortably until midday or later. However, with your goals in mind and with the idea in mind, in my particular case, and I want to state that because it might be people in different categories have different decision making. But in my case, good blood values, no risk factors, optimal body fat level, and having ambitious fitness peak performance goals, he said, go eat more food, man. Get more nutrition into your body rather than trying to extend out your fasting abilities and your caloric efficiency abilities as is so popular in the keto scene. So I embrace that. I'm now in 8 weeks here of increased caloric intake, especially doing a green smoothie every morning, macronutrient balance with good sources of fat, a lot of vegetable matter, and good nutrition getting into my body.
What do you put in your smoothie?
I'm freezing all these vegetables. This was a suggestion Dr. Tommy had on a YouTube video or something where you just throw kale. I put lime and lemon, the entire half wedge of the product in there, celery, beets, things like that. So they're in a frozen state. So that makes the smoothie icy when you pour them in there. You have a base of something with fat, like unsweetened almond milk or coconut milk, assorted powders and performance agents that are custom that I'm taking. Like one of them's creatine, I noticed. One of them's carnitine, which helps with fat burning. Putting some MCT oil in there is another practice that I'm enjoying, getting that fat content up. A scoop of protein powder or a scoop of primal fuel or primal collagen for protein. So it's a lot in there, and I'm not an expert, so a lot of times it comes out so thick that I have to eat it with a spoon. So it's like a little bowl of purple or blue oatmeal, Brian McAndrew style, our sound and video guy here at Primal. He's the king of morning. You can't call it a smoothie. You got to call it a green bowl of slop, but a lot of nutrition in there.
I have one, and mine is sort of like a cold soup. It's like a vichyssoise because it's almost exclusively vegetables, but it's like the same idea. It's too thick to be called a smoothie, and it's sort of you drink it, but it's a lumpy.
So I'm blabbing about my smoothie because I've noticed with this increased caloric intake for the past 7 or 8 weeks, I feel like I have a bump in performance and a faster recovery from doing the hard stuff. So I'm still trying to discover that fine line between, the longevity benefits and the cellular repair benefits of fasting and the need for high nutritional requirements. So one of the things I'll mention is that there's never any call to consume nutrient deficient junk food in the name of that you're burning calories as an athlete. And I think we've been doing that very poorly for the last 50 years, where the people are running their miles, burning their calories, and coming home and having a hot fudge sundae and calling it even just because they don't have excessive body fat. So what I'm talking about is increasing the nutrient content of your diet with good choices and monitoring for a performance benefit, or possible any negative effects, which might be putting on excess body fat, but that's kind of hard to imagine.
It's a strange personality to me, the person that does a track workout and then comes home and thinks they deserve a reward of a hot fudge sundae. It's like, well, no, the being healthy enough to do the track workout, that's the reward, it's and coming home and saying, I deserve this hot fudge sundae doesn't really make sense to me. I guess I'm not, as Brad was saying, common, but
I did say you were common.
Yes, I know.
But you're getting out with this, your famous pizza line from all shows past also, where the person was saying, yeah, it's a big sacrifice to cut out pizza. And you said, wait a second, I thought the sacrifice was to eat the pizza because it's unhealthy for you and it makes bloating, gas, excess body fat, all that stuff.
So makes you feel better, feel worse, sleep worse, have less patience to deal with your family and your work. Has an adverse effect on concentration and brain function. And it's like, and you think the sacrifice is not eating that? It's people's perspectives are different. They're looking at it the wrong side. Getting people to understand that they're looking at it from the wrong side is the tricky part. But once you do, then, they almost all of them, if you can get them to do it for 3 weeks, eat well, they notice the difference. they notice the difference.
Yeah, I think it's a question of this instant gratification that we're socialized to and also genetically wired for. We know that we're wired for a sweet tooth. Rob Wolf's book, Wired to Eat, getting into the science of that. And so the balance between that social acceptance and that instant gratification versus, for example, in many cases, behaving in a manner that's congruent with your stated goals, such as I'm trying to reduce excess body fat, but oh, I can't resist that that dessert tray that you're passing around. And I think overall, you know, we're on the same page here, where if you wake up the next morning and assess the entire experience, it's probably a net negative because you did enjoy the taste of the item. And maybe you made the host happy because they made a homemade treat for you and they want you so bad to eat it, and all these impure influences going into the picture. But when you wake up and say, wow, you know, I've made the stated goal, I've formed the intention to reduce excess body fat or improve my diet because I have adverse blood values or whatever your motivations are, and then not doing it, I think that's a slippery slope into diminished self-esteem, diminished self-respect, diminished self-discipline, and then all of a sudden you're down into the rationalizations. My favorite one, or I should say my most objectionable one, is, hey, life is short, everything in moderation. And that part...
I love Johnny G's answer to that. Johnny G and Brad and I were out on a ride 30 years ago. And, you know, we're all sort of extreme people, right? Because we're endurance athletes and we were pushing the envelope of what the body was capable of doing.
I think the ride was 140 milers, yes. So that is a little bit on the unusual.
On the unusual long side. Anyway, so Johnny was talking about these things and I was like, well, we got to do a little bit more moderation than that. Johnny's like, yeah, I want to be moderately successful and moderately happy and moderately healthy and moderately fit. And he really got angry.
My goal is to perform moderately in the upcoming race. Good stuff.
I love that. I mean... You know, it was a funny moment then, but it's a great moment now. Whenever anyone says, well, you know, I just, you know, everything in moderation, well, yeah, like happiness, that's a good idea. Good for you. Moderately happy. Good for you.
Well, in the case of the presentation of foods in modern society, we are talking about a disgraceful marketing machine that puts human health second to corporate profit. And I'm not just sounding off as a wise guy. Dr. Kate Shanahan has done some great shows. You can search for her online, talking about the vegetable oils and the suppression of good science by marketing forces, so that, you know, we were convinced strongly to transition away from butter into vegetable oils decades ago. And it was basically an experiment by the food manufacturers to see, you know, just how many people are going to die when we serve them up this crap that's going to make us more money. And I think she has a name for it, like the Great Human Food Experiment. And we're in it right now. I'm going to answer the challenge here with a quote from Doug McGuff, who said, look, the science and the government and the pillars of conventional wisdom will all come around, but these are slow-moving bureaucratic beasts, and it's going to take them 20 years. And what he was talking about was, you know, the paleo or the low-carb or the ancestral health movement is going to be completely 100% validated. It's going to take 20 years. And he said, personally, I don't feel like waiting that long, so I'm going to take action right now in my life to do things that are healthy and that are clearly, you know, we've clearly failed with all the even fitness efforts by conventional society, because mainly we're talking about a huge attrition and burnout in the mainstream fitness movement, like the team and training group training programs, which are wonderful. They raise money for charity. They get people off the couch and into a marathon finish line. But generally speaking, my contention is the way they're formulated is they're putting too much stress on people that can't take it, and they wind it up. Same with the personal training industry and all the other things.
Yeah, the team and training, what it does is it gets thousands of people out there for 10 weeks or 8 weeks, and then they don't do it. And then they sign up for the race again the next year because they had fun doing the event, whether they walk it or run it or whatever. But it's not, it doesn't become their lifestyle. It's something that they do for a short period of time. And as a coach, that's not my goal. My goal isn't to see how fit I can get you in 3 months. My goal is to make you love the sport for 20 more years or more.
Which means your first event might be a mini sprint, try in the water, swim 200 meters, bike 10 miles, run 2, instead of the Honolulu Marathon, where you have to raise $4,000 to go out there and you're going to do it for sure, and you're unlikely to continue because it's too extreme and too stressful.
Well, my favorite answer is when someone says, do you think I can do a marathon or do you think I can do an Ironman? My answer is always, yeah, you know, but why would you want to? You know, I mean, doesn't it make sense to do something that's A, fun to train for, and B, has way fewer adverse effects on your health? You know, the shorter stuff is way better for you. But you know, if someone wants to do an Ironman, you can do one tomorrow. They're really not that hard. You just have to get up and keep going. Go slow and eat and you'll get there. You know, don't ever go so fast that you're getting tired, you know, and most people can make it. You know, I mean, it's not that difficult.
Well, I say often that if I put a gun to your head, you can make it right now. We'll go out right now. We'll find a place to swim 2.4, bicycle 112, and run 26.2. You're going to be in bad shape at the end if you're not properly trained, but you will make it if there's a gun to your head. Run a marathon, run an ultra, whatever it is that you're talking about. But what's the point if it's going to be a destructive overall experience?
One of my favorite things about marathons is you get the guy that ran 205 and the guy that ran 502, and they're both walking with straight knees because it hurts too much to bend their knees the next day. And that's what the great equalizer, you know. And it's the same feeling the day after, whether you ran super fast or not so fast. And that's what's great about these long things. Now, doing them regularly, like people who run, you know, a marathon every 2 months or an Ironman 3 times a year, that's probably not the best choice, is all I'm saying.
And I think that's so much to think about. We should package that up into a tidying little show, and we'll talk about, we'll get back to that big picture question that we started this show with on the next episode. But thanks for listening.
Same bat channel.
Da-da-da-da-da-da. Hi, this is Brad Kearns to tell you about Primal Endurance Online Multimedia Educational Mastery Course. And what we have done for the past year is basically bring the book Primal Endurance to life with a series of videos and other multimedia educational material, audio, ebooks, all accessed at this online portal with everything you need to succeed in endurance training. And if you're trying to do this stuff, if you're enjoying these compelling challenges and trying not to get sick, injured, burnt out, fried, this is going to help you approach your endurance goals in a healthy, balanced manner and promote your health rather than compromise it. Get away from carbohydrate dependency and progress toward fat adaptation. It's over 120 videos. Many with the experts and also many others with the step-by-step instruction of what's in the book. So if you're too busy to read or you'd like to have a more comprehensive learning experience, check out Primal Endurance Online. You'll have everything you need there at primalendurance.fit.